Talking Birds.
Made possible by the generous support of the Birdwatchers General Store, Route 6A, Orleans, Cape Cod. On the web at birdwatchersgeneralstore.com. By the Boston Harbor Island Alliance. Minutes away, worlds apart. Go to bostonharborislands.org for more information.
I love Talking Birds. I love that show.
Good morning. Welcome to our show number 549. Well, thanks to our friends at the Patuxent National Wildlife Refuge in Laurel, Maryland, who were such gracious hosts when we brought our Talking Birds show to the refuge last Sunday, November 1st. Great thanks to our on-air guests, Refuge Manager Brad Knudsen and Wildlife Research Director Dr. John French. Thanks, too, to Jeff Edgar for his able assistance with our broadcast. And very special thanks to Ken Lavish, who made it possible for our visit to happen and who was most generous indeed with his time in showing us around the refuge and giving us some great glimpses of whooping cranes. And we heard them, too. That was pretty cool. And sandhill cranes, too, which we also saw and heard. Some serious vocalization going on there. And lots of sea ducks that we saw in the research enclosures there at the refuge. Meanwhile, if you think you might be in the McAllen, Texas area on Sunday, November 15th, you're hereby invited to head over to Estero Llano Grande State Park, just west of McAllen. We're planning to originate our Talking Bird show from that very birdie location on that date. That's Sunday, November 15th. Well, it's been said that one could draw a direct line of great artist naturalists from John James Audubon through Roger Torrey Peterson to David Allen Sibley, and we're quite thrilled that the third person in that line, David Allen Sibley, is right here in the studio with us this morning. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Ray.
Great to have you with you. Is it significant that all you guys have three names?
That's a funny story about really? That. Most people have three names, I think.
Yeah, but don't necessarily use them all.
Yeah, and when my book was about to, they were in the process of setting up the marketing plan for it, back in 1999, the head of marketing at Knopf came to me and said, "What's your middle name?" And I told him, he said, "Oh, that's good, that's good.
Yeah, a good one.
Yeah. You mind if we use it? Because that seems to be the way bird artists go."
Okay, well, there's a logical explanation for it after all. All right, interesting. Just to back up my description there, David, this is a beautiful quote from the New York Times. It appears on your Sibley Guide to Birds second edition, and it says, "Once in a great while, a natural history book changes the way people look at the world. In 1838, John James Audubon's Birds of America was won. In 1934, Roger Torrey Peterson produced Field Guide to the Birds. Now comes the Sibley Guide to Birds." And that's referring to your first edition of your Sibley Guide, which kind of made a little bit of noise back in the year 2000.
Yeah, it was quite a surprise and very gratifying, of course.
I'm sure. Considered to be, by many, the most comprehensive guide for North American field identification. One of many guides and publications from David. And, of course, David, these books all came about after many years of study and field experience with birds. Can you give us a thumbnail sketch about how you got started in birding and how you became so immersed in it? And are you still interested?
Yeah, I still find birds fascinating. And I learn new things every day. But I started as a kid. I can't remember a time when I wasn't interested in birds. Mm. And my father's an ornithologist, mm-hmm. so that was probably in part responsible for my early interest, but also mm-hmm. a tremendous resource. And he was able to open all kinds of doors and give me all kinds of opportunities as a kid. Mm-hmm. So I studied and sketched and watched birds through my school years and started college, and then decided that I wanted to learn different things about birds than what they were going to teach me at college. So mm-hmm. I set off on my own And it was about 10 years after that, after traveling the country, just watching birds and sketching and traveling on my own, that I started working on the field guide full time.
And the field guide, which people now often refer to, but instead of by a generic word, field guide, people call it their Sibley.
Yeah. Right.
Did you move my Sibley, Margaret? It was right here on the table. You're like Kleenex, or not Kleenex, Scotch tape,
yeah.
Kind of thing. Well, David, here we are on the 8th of November, so we're in, I guess this is late fall now. Give us an overview, can you, of this sort of time period. We have insectivore migration winding down, other species, seed eaters and fruit eaters hanging around, winter finches thinking about coming down to the lower 48, starting to.
Yeah, and fall migration is such a protracted event. It begins in late June with some sandpipers beginning to migrate south. And then about August and September, you get the peak of the insectivores moving south, warblers, vireos, flycatchers. Mm-hmm. And now we're into the seed and fruit-eating birds and water birds. There's this broad pattern. It makes sense if your life depends on eating insects, you can't afford to get caught in Massachusetts after a freeze, mm-hmm. and the freeze might have extended all the way to South Carolina. Mm-hmm. You've got hundreds of miles before you're going to find an insect. So all those birds have evolved to migrate before there's any chance of a freeze. So they leave in August and September. Well, they'll be assured of finding insects all along their route, and they're gone and out into the Caribbean or South America or Central America by the end of September. And the birds that are left behind that are migrating now are the sparrows, finches, robins, birds that can survive on fruit and seeds, and they have a much later migration. They don't have to leave early. Mm-hmm. They can find food now and right into the winter.
And we're seeing more and more, I think it's safe to say, of these birds, like robins as an example, that aren't going anywhere, or maybe just traveling short distances and hanging around for the entire winter. People are always saying, you know, how they're shocked when they see a robin in February. What's going on?
Yeah.
You know, but it's not that unusual.
Yeah, robins. Well, even when I was a kid in Connecticut in the 1970s, robins were a sign of spring, that it was hard to find robins in January and February. Yeah. So it's just in 40 years they have transformed from being mostly leaving New England in the winter to big flocks, thousands now stay right through the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that probably has to do mostly with the availability of a lot of fruit. A lot of the invasive plants have fruit, buckthorn, bittersweet. And a lot of people have planted crab apples and other fruit-bearing plants in their gardens in the suburbs. So there's a lot of food for robins that wasn't here 40, 50 years ago.
Why leave? We've got it all right here in our backyard, literally. So then birds arriving in the lower 48 from points to the north, siskins, crossbills, grosbeaks, redpolls. Are we going to see a lot this year, do you think?
I think it's all those species depend, they wander in winter depending on where they find food, and the trees, that they're mostly eating seeds of trees, so either pines, spruces, hemlocks, or for the redpolls, it's birch is their main food source. And the trees produce seeds on an irregular schedule, so the birds have to wander every winter looking for food. And you never really know. I think the forecast is that there is an ornithologist in Ontario who puts out a forecast every fall, talking to foresters about what the seed crop is like in different areas and where the birds are being seen in the summer, tries to guess where they might end up in the winter. And he's predicting small flights of some species, but nothing really big this winter. Right. But you never know.
I should say, you never know.
Happens.
We're talking with David Allen Sibley. We'll talk more about seabirds coming up. Still to come on our show today, our man Mike O'Connor from Cape Cod's famous Birdwatchers General Store will try to offer some relief to a listener whose house is under downy woodpecker attack. Also, we'll present our famous mystery bird contest and give away a fabulous feeder from Droll Yankees in the process. And up next, we'll meet a bird that presents a stiff tail, a bright blue bill, and a sound kind of like an outboard motor starting up. It's our Talking Birds featured feathered friend. Well, listen to what our friends across the pond have to say to us.
We don't want your bloody ruddy.
Well, clearly those twitchers in merry old England are not pleased with a bird that we think is pretty nice, the ruddy duck. Oh, twitchers, by the way, is what our English birdwatcher friends call themselves. So why do the flyers of the Union Jack want to ground the ruddy duck? Well, for a pretty good reason, really. Because having established themselves in Great Britain and parts of mainland Europe, ruddy ducks are interbreeding with the endangered native white-headed duck. And in England, up with that, they will not put. So there is now a controversial plan underway to wipe out the ruddy duck as a British breeding species. Beautiful bird, though it may be. The male has a bright blue bill, large white cheek patches, black head and neck, and bright cinnamon color over most of its body. And instead of a stiff upper lip, it has that very distinctive long, stiff tail, which it often holds straight up to display. The ruddy duck is generally quiet, except at breeding time, when you'll hear this from the male. Hey, we even like the way it sounds. So, English friends, send us your huddled masses of ruddy ducks yearning to breed free. Sorry about that. The ruddy duck, today's Talkin' Birds featured feathered friend. Read an update the other day that the folks over there have pretty much gotten rid of all the ruddy ducks. They've been doing that in a very concentrated manner for a while. It looks like they have pretty well succeeded. Well, we're happy again to have David Sibley, author and illustrator of the famous Sibley Guide to Birds and many other publications, with us here in the studio. And David, when we left off there before our featured bird, we said we'd talk about seabird species. What are we? What are you excited about looking for right about now?
Well, it's November is a fantastic month for seeing seabird migration and, mm-hmm. and water birds in general. They're moving south ahead of the freeze, or sometimes waiting until the water freezes and then taking off mm-hmm. and moving south. So as the cold fronts come and we get cold nights. We'll notice big movements of birds heading south to find open water. And just this morning, for example, I got here with about half an hour to spare and went out to the waterfront in Marshfield to look, and in 20 minutes saw probably 10 common loons, 10 red-throated loons, a bunch of scoters, a few golden eyes,
wow.
30 gannets. These seabirds are just on the move, and it doesn't matter when you go. Just go to the beach and train your binoculars in the distance offshore, and you will see birds migrating. It's just fantastic.
And seabird migration, I don't know, the sense is it's pretty complicated. There's a lot we don't know. Is that true about seabird migration?
Yeah, and migration in general. The seabird migration, it's concentrated for these species like scoters and loons. It's concentrated in a very narrow band right along the waterfront, right along the beach. So you get this narrow band of migrating birds, and imagine sort of a conveyor belt, a ribbon of birds maybe a couple miles wide, mm-hmm. extending all the way from Massachusetts to Florida. Most of these species don't get much farther offshore. They just They make their way to the coast, and then they follow the shoreline all the way down.
Mm-hmm. So we've been seeing reports from these pelagic tours here on the East Coast, and talked to folks in California recently on tours out in Monterey Bay and other places. And in both cases, they're saying they're seeing more seabirds this year than they've seen in 30 or 40 years. What's going on there?
Yeah. Well, the birds follow the food, and the seabirds, mm-hmm. Seabirds especially, congregate where there's a lot of food. And I know that, I mean, here off Massachusetts at Stellwagen Banks, the water is warmer than usual, mm-hmm. and for whatever reason, that apparently led to an explosion of the bait fish that the birds like to feed on. And it's just been phenomenal. The thousands and thousands of shearwaters and lots of other seabirds have been just off Provincetown, just off mm-hmm. the tip of Cape Cod, mm-hmm. all summer, visible from land and thousands seen from any of the whale-watching boats.
So great for birders, but not necessarily for the birds, because we don't know what's going on here, where these birds are being upset by warmer ocean waters, right?
Yeah, we know that they're congregated in these places very close to shore, where a lot of birders go and see them. So it seems like there are a lot more, but it's probably just drawing birds in from elsewhere. Like other mm-hmm. years, these birds might be mm-hmm. dispersed across Georgia's Bank, a couple hundred miles offshore or off of the coast of Newfoundland or up near Greenland. Who knows? They wander around looking for food, mm-hmm. and what we're seeing now is probably just a concentration in this one small area in a place that happens to be very conspicuous and, mm-hmm. and easy for birders to see.
It calls to mind the idea of cod out in Gulf of Maine, where fishermen are saying, hey, we're seeing tremendous numbers of cod in these certain places, but maybe like the birds, they're concentrated in these places and absent elsewhere.
Yeah. And these seabirds, the Corey's shearwater has been a big part of this. The numbers off Cape Cod this summer, mm-hmm. record numbers of Corey's shearwaters. That's a warm water species that nests in the Mediterranean and on islands just off of Europe and Africa, the Canary Islands and Cape Verde Islands. So they're coming across the Atlantic to spend their non-breeding season here. And what we're seeing is just the birds that are sort of biding time, trying to survive, mm-hmm. molting in their non-breeding season, and they'll go back to those islands to nest. The great shearwaters that are also here in big numbers nest on mainly one island in the South Atlantic and come here in huge numbers to spend the southern winter, the northern summer, they're here. Mm-hmm. But again, it's just the non-breeding season, so they're sort of footloose and fancy-free, just going wherever the food is. But the health of their population probably depends more on protecting those nesting sites and whatever the food mm-hmm. resources are there during the breeding season so that they can successfully raise young.
We're going to keep an eye on our clock here. We're poor at clock management around here. We're going to move on to the Mystery Bird Contest in just 1 minute.
Here's an idea for the next time you're shopping for wild bird food. Look for the Audubon Park brand, a top choice among bird lovers for more than 40 years. That's because Audubon Park wild bird seed is the finest kind, with more than a dozen selections to choose from, including the popular fruit and nut, songbird and cardinal, and no-waste patio blends. Human development and climate change are having increasing impacts on wild birds. Feeding the hummers, chickadees, goldfinches, cardinals, and all the beautiful and fascinating birds in your backyard really helps them survive and thrive. All of Audubon Park's products meet the highest quality standards in the industry and have earned early compliance with the FDA's Food Safety Modernization Act. And Audubon Park products are easy to find at your supermarket, lawn and garden store, farm and feed market, and online retailers. For more information, visit AudubonPark.com. That's AudubonPark.com. Audubon Park wild bird food is made right here in the USA. Get some for your backyard birds today. Audubon Park wild bird food.
Talking Birds is made possible in part by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, a world leader in the study, appreciation, and conservation of birds. Please check them out at birds.cornell.edu. Our Mystery Bird Contest is underway. We urge you to call in and as soon as you can so we don't run out of time. We are, as often happens, a little behind schedule here. Here's the number to call at 781-837-4900, 781-837-4900. Don't forget you can hear our show live online anytime. Just go to talkingbirds.com. Our prize is a Droll Yankees New Generation Peanut Feeder with a stainless steel tube that's perfect for a pound of peanuts or black oil, sunflower seed, or whatever you want to put in there. It's your feeder if you win it. 781-837-4900 is the number. Here is the sound of our mystery bird. Our pretty large mystery bird can be as long as 21 inches, is an inhabitant of fast-flowing streams in summer and the surf of rocky coastlines in the winter. It dives for its prey, including fish and marine invertebrates and insects. The striking male has a white patch in front of the eyes and a round white ear spot. He's dark slate blue with reddish-brown sides and white patches and spots. The female is kind of dusky brown with two or three round white spots on the head. You can tell from that it's a pretty spectacular duck, certainly the male. What do you think it is? 781-837-4900 is the number. And if you don't know, well, take a guess, because no correct answer means a drawing will determine our winner. 781-837-4900 is the number. Meanwhile, Downies are drilling in somebody's house. Mike tries to help. Let's ask Mike with Mike O'Connor from the Birdwatchers General Store on Cape Cod. Let's ask Mike in just 1 minute. Right in Boston's backyard lies a magnificent resource where you can walk a Civil War-era fort, explore tide pools, and camp under the stars. Once known as the city's hidden gem, the Boston Harbor Islands National Park area has become the go-to urban escape for tourists and residents alike. It's a marvelous destination for birders, offering a huge variety of migrating and nesting species that can be viewed independently or during free ranger-guided bird walks on Saturday mornings. The islands are home to other wildlife, too, including deer, fox, coyote, rabbits, raccoons, muskrats, squirrels, and harbor seals. There are countless activities for non-birders as well, like hiking on miles of trails, sunny beaches, ocean fishing, concerts, deer tastings, and programs for the whole family. 34 islands, 3,000 acres, endless fun and exploration, all minutes from Boston. Find out more at bostonharborislands.org. Okay, our topic for Mike this morning is woodpeckers. Not just any woodpeckers, but drilling woodpeckers. Hey, Mike, good morning.
Hey, good morning to you, Ray.
This is a question from Matthew in Evanston, Illinois.
Whoa!
He says, a question for Mike. Within the last month, downy woodpeckers have begun drilling 2 to 3 inch holes in the cedar clapboard siding of my house. Is it still pronounced clapboard or is it clapboard?
I'll go with whatever you say.
Clapboard, okay. I immediately repair the holes as they're made, but the downies keep coming back. What control methods can you recommend, says Matthew.
Matthew, you're not alone. You're in real good company. We probably get a dozen calls of this every day. And I don't know, and downies, you know, are the most often the cause
most
of it.
Most likely, yeah.
And, you know, everybody's got to guess what it is. Are there insects, which is a possibility. Some people think they can feel the vibration from the electric wires in the building, which the birds think are insects.
Yeah.
Other people think they're just drilling holes for roosting, and then certain times of year they bang on the houses to announce their territory. There's a lot of reasons, but at the end of that, how the hell do you stop them from doing that? Sometimes you're lucky they'll drill on a pipe, like a downspout or a gutter or an old antenna or a chimney cap or something. But when they go in the wood, then you got to take some steps. Over the years, we've tried a bunch of different things, from rubber snakes to plastic owls to mirrors to all kinds of things. Mm. And this week, we're kind of endorsing this Mylar tape that you can buy at garden centers or just a lot of different places to sell. Because it's meant for people to keep birds from, like, stealing their blueberries and things like that.
Mm.
And so you get the strips of this, and you hang it down, perhaps like a beaded curtain. You put it, fingers of it hanging down over the area where the birds are coming.
Mm.
And it seems to work pretty well. The reports have been good the last year or so. The people who have been doing it, seems like it's worked very well. I think you're doing a good idea, Matthew, is filling in the holes, because the birds seem to be attracted to holes. They see holes, they think, okay, some woodpeckers found some food, I'm going to investigate.
Let's make some more.
Yeah, that's right. Let's check this out. So if you patch up the holes and then you put this stuff, you hang it down, like I said, like beaded curtains. It seems to do a good job of getting them to go, you know, hopefully to the neighbor's house.
That's the best you can hope for, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, we'll have our neighbor relations segment next week. But for now, there's an answer for Matthew. Thank you, Mike.
Okay, we'll talk to you next week.
Talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Send your question into Mike, and the address is ray@talkinbirds.com. No G in talking. And if you'd like a copy of Mike's newest book, Why Do Bluebirds Hate Me, we'll just send include your mailing address with your question, and we'll send a copy, a signed copy of that book out to you. Meanwhile, we're back here at the Mystery Bird Contest. David Sibley is with us here in studio, and we're trying to identify this mystery bird. Pretty large bird, as long as 21 inches. It's an inhabitant of fast-flowing streams in summer or the surf of rocky coastlines in winter. It dives for its prey, including fish and marine invertebrates and insects. The striking male has a white patch in front of the eyes and a round white ear spot. He's dark slate blue with reddish-brown sides and white patches and spots. The female, kind of a dusky brown with two or three round white spots on the head. And I kind of accidentally gave a clue as to what this bird is by saying what kind of the family it belongs to there, but we'll see who paid attention to that and if that would help. 781-837-4900 is the number. Vivian is in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Good morning, Vivian.
Hello.
Hello. Say hello to David Sibley.
Hello.
Hi, Vivian.
Vivian actually called us last week, and somehow we lost her. I remember that because we were talking about Albuquerque in a different context, and suddenly there she was. But what do you say, Vivian, on our mystery bird?
I think it's the green heron.
The green heron. Is it the green heron, David?
No, I'm afraid not.
If David says it isn't, then I think it isn't. But Vivian, Thank you so much. Try us again.
All right. I will.
Well, I have to confess that I would not have gotten this on the sound.
Uh-huh. Not a sound you would normally hear.
No.
hear
it's a sound that you very, very rarely hear at all.
We could give another clue to that, and that is that thanks to that sound, this bird has a nickname of the sea mouse. Ted is in Lynn, Massachusetts. Good morning, Ted.
Yes, good morning, Ray.
Good morning. Say hello to David Sibley in studio with us here.
Morning, Dave. How's it going?
Hi, Ted. It's going well, thanks.
What do you think, Ted, on our mystery bird? What do you say it is?
I'm thinking it's the Harlequin duck.
Good thinking, right?
That is correct.
Our studio audience got in before you did, David, to say that was right. The Harlequin duck, sometimes known as the sea mouse. Ted, good job. Stay on the line, and we'll get your address and send you that Droll Yankees feeder.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ted. The Harlequin duck, a really beautiful species, is our mystery bird. David, we are so close to being out of time here. I wanted to get a quick idea. You're a book guy, but you have an app now as well. What do you think about all these apps and mechanical ways of identifying birds? Are we missing something or losing something by these all this electronic aid stuff, or is it a good thing?
I think it's a mixed bag, like any technology. It's the digital format makes it so much easier to carry an unlimited amount of information in your pocket with a phone that people are already carrying. But a book can do things that an app can't. You can browse 20 different images all at once on the open pages of a book, and you can't do that in an app.
Still can't replace a book. David Sibley, the author and illustrator of the famous Sibley Guide to Birds and many other publications. David, thank you so much for being with us, and we hope you'll be back again soon.
My pleasure. I hope so, too.
Next week, a live broadcast from the Estero Llano State Park, just east of McAllen, Texas, in the Rio Grande Valley. Hope you will be with us there in person or at home or in your car, wherever you might be listening. Executive producer of Talking Birds, Mark Duffield. Associate producer, Debbie Bleacher. Our engineer is Tim McKenney. I'm Ray Brown. See you next week.
The Bird Show. I like that.
Ray Brown's Talking Birds.
Made possible by the generous support of the Birdwatchers General Store, Route 6A, Orleans, Cape Cod. On the web at birdwatchersgeneralstore.com. By the Boston Harbor Island Alliance. Minutes away, worlds apart. Go to bostonharborislands.org for more information.
I love Talking Birds. I love that show.
do 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 do